Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
LeBron James looks right, makes an utterly convincing move to suggest he's going left, and then blows directly by his defender and dunks the ball, demonstrating that whenever he feels like it, James can get to the basket any way he wants to. Call it athletic brilliance. Call it dominance on the basketball court. Call it unfair, especially if you're on the other team. Chris Ballard calls it art, which is why his new book is titled The Art of a Beautiful Game. And when we spoke recently about the book, I began the conversation by asking Chris when he first began thinking of basketball's most extraordinary practitioners as artists.
Probably when I hit a level as a player, and I played small college ball, Division III for a little bit, and I got to a point where I realized, okay, the basketball that I've been playing growing up and that I watch when I'm watching a game, which is often the ball. You know, you grow up, you watch the NBA, you watch college basketball, and whoever has the ball, you watch that player. And you say, okay, he either made that shot or he didn't. And that's sort of like your elemental introduction to watching the NBA. And then all these other elements are involved in this. And as a player, that kicked in for me. And then I started watching the game differently and saying, okay, I'm going to watch the guy off the ball, the guy on the far side of the court. What's he doing? And how important is that to the game? And then you see all this start, this interplay occur, all these other things are involved in it, and it sort of, that was when I really began to get deeper into the game.
In order to discuss the various specialties players have developed, you write about several different individuals, Dwight Howard and Ben Wallace as magnificent rebounders, for example, former Chicago Bulls player Steve Kerr as a pure shooter, and so on. But of course, Steve Kerr had been retired as a player for 5 years when you approached him as the subject for that chapter. What did he think about the idea?
Yeah, Steve was a very good sport, let's put it that way. You know, he's always been media friendly to a certain extent, and I think he saw a bit of a challenge in it. And my thesis was, okay, pure shooters are born. This is sort of an idea in basketball, and I wondered, okay, does it ever go away? So the idea with Kerr was, okay, let's pull him out of cold storage. He's been retired 5 years. You know, he tells me he doesn't even play basketball anymore. He plays a little bit of tennis. And I say, well, Steve, you know, would you be nice enough to engage me in this shooting contest so I could try to prove or disprove this theory?
Tell me a little bit about how that shooting contest with Steve Kerr did work out.
There was one little moment of drama wherein we decided to shoot some college three-pointers, and then some NBA three-pointers, and then we were going to play horse. And the NBA one was probably the element I was most curious about how Kerr would perform, because that was his specialty. So we came out, and I hit 12 out of 25, which I figured was good enough for me. And Kerr starts shooting, and he misses three of his first six. And so at that point, you know, I got this sort of thought in the back of my mind, you know, maybe there's a chance here. Kerr proceeds to hit all but one of the rest of the shots. He hits 21 out of 25 NBA three-pointers coming out cold, walked down from his office in tennis shoes. It was remarkable. I mean, that would win the NBA three-point shootout.
So your conclusion was, yes, there is such a thing as a pure shooter.
Indeed, and only bolstered when we played horse, and he did not miss a single shot, including a 40-footer. Actually, he missed one from over the backboard, but that was it. It would have been humiliating if it were not so impressive.
I was intrigued by your chapter about the free throw. I have never understood why guys who are paid millions and millions of dollars to play basketball don't work hard enough at foul shots to get good at them. Did you learn anything about that?
A tremendous amount, and I went into it with this same concept as you said, Bill, and I started talking to him, and there's a lot involved there, and a lot of it, I think, is based on pride. If you focused on that, it's not, you know, to an extent, it's not really sexy. and the amount of practice that it takes to be a very good free throw shooter, these guys practice 100 shots, 200 shots a day. You know, I met with this guy who holds the Guinness record, 2,750 in a row, and he did that as a retired podiatrist at age 71. So it's like, if he can do that, you know, why can't Dwight Howard hit 6 out of 10? And Dwight's an interesting case. He told me he hears it all. You know, you're at the game and you're in the third deck, you yell something, you figure no one ever hears you. Dwight hears you. And he says, I hear that guy in the third deck. So last year he actually started humming songs to himself, Beyonce songs, at the free throw line so that he wouldn't hear people yelling at him. He's so far in his own head he's not a bad free throw shooter in practice, same as Shaq. These guys will hit 70-80% in practice. They get out there, and suddenly all that physical ability that allows them to dominate, you know, power, strength, it's all gone, and it's all mental.
When you were researching your chapter on defensive specialists, Nate McMillan, who was a defensive specialist in the NBA for 12 years, told you that guys like him, quote, didn't need attention. But don't all NBA players get more attention than they can possibly handle, no matter what roles they play?
Yeah, and probably what he meant was positive attention. I think that's probably the delineation there. They're all going to be, you know, scrutinized, and you're going to be blamed or maybe lauded, depending on the game. And what I think Nate was getting at is this idea that the things that that defensive specialist does, unless they're a shot blocker, are things that no one notices. No one in the greater fan media arena. Certainly there are some people, but when you read those game stories, it's never, now it's a little more evolved, but certainly in Nate's day, it was never, okay, McMillan held so-and-so to 5 of 14 shooting and had 9 deflections. That's not your lead. Your lead is, you know, Gary Payton had 24 points and 11 assists.
One of the interesting points you make when you write about defense is that a defensive player who holds a great scorer to 35 points may still have done a terrific job in that game, mm-hmm. as long as his team wins and those 35 points don't beat him.
Yeah, and they often judge it by how many shot attempts. So Shane Battier of the Rockets, his equation is, if I can hold him to 1 point per shot, that's a good night for me. And that works on two levels. One is the field goal percentage. Let's say it's, you know, 25 points on 25 shots. That means the field goal percentage is probably not too good for that shooter, A. And B, it means he didn't get to the line a lot. And free throws are the most efficient way to score in the NBA. If a guy scores 40 points, but it takes him 30-some shots to get there, the defender still says, well, they had to run all their offense through this guy. He probably wasn't creating for his teammates. He didn't get to the line. Chances are we probably won that game.
One of the things that surprised me as I read through the book, the different sections of it, was the gap between players in the NBA. There are a lot of players in the NBA who dread particular matchups because they just know that the LeBron Jameses of the world are just better than they are.
Yeah, and it must be one of those elements that only if you're on that floor out there on an island, as they say, and Battier referred it to me as, I don't want to be on Kobe Island. Yeah, that's how he that's how he describes it, which I loved, was that phrase, Kobe Island. If you're out there, there must be an understanding of there are only certain things that I can do to score on this guy and only certain things I can do to stop him. And the rest of it, really, at guys at that level, like Ray Allen on a jump shot, you know, there's only, if he's coming off a screen, there's only so much you can do. He's going to hit the majority of those shots. And especially physically, like with LeBron, you know, there's no one in the NBA that can match him physically. You've got a couple guys like Ron Artest who are as big and strong as him, but Ron can't jump like LeBron. And you got a couple guys who can jump like him, but they're not as big and strong as him. So really, when you watch any matchup with LeBron, everyone is at a disadvantage. That's a team defense situation.
It was interesting to me that you began the book with a chapter discussing Kobe Bryant, who is without question a brilliant player. You especially praise his mindset and his determination to impose his will on the opposition. And even on his teammates, you talk about how he has to be the alpha male on the team. But did you consider including in your presentation of Bryant his adultery and the fact that a civil charge of rape was settled out of court?
It didn't seem relevant to a basketball conversation. I think from the perspective of probably what drove him, that was, you know, mildly relevant. And that would certainly fit into something that affected his off-the-court stuff. But I don't think it ever affected Kobe too much on the court. I think he was able to always be a basketball guy. I'm not one to judge Kobe as a human being, but I didn't write a chapter about him as a human being for obvious reasons. I think there are, you know, he's obviously a flawed person in ways that many athletes are, but that's almost an example of how effective he is at channeling his energy, that during that time period when he was on trial and it was all, you know, it was all over the media and he was flying back from that trial, he would still be so effective in games. I couldn't be that way. I mean, I don't know if that says anything good or bad about him, but it certainly says he's able to become totally obsessively focused on basketball.
You say you weren't writing about these players in terms of what they did or didn't do off the court, but there is a sense through the book, I think, of the extent to which you admire these guys. There is, I think, a tremendous sense of admiration. Did I misread that?
No, there is. And for me, it's a matter of I've always in my journalistic work been drawn to people who are like almost obsessive about whatever their job is. I wrote a book about people who are really, really good at very strange, obscure things. And so what I liked about the guys I chose is that all of them saw this not as, okay, I'm playing basketball or I'm making money or I'm becoming famous, but they really were nerdy about whatever it was they were doing. So when Ben Wallace thinks about rebounding, he thinks about this in the same way that if you find someone who's really good at whatever job it is, you know, postman, blacksmith, but they get really into it and you want to talk to them about it, they become super passionate. And that's what I liked about these guys. And this doesn't apply to all NBA players, obviously, and there's plenty who have talent they're not using. But a lot of these guys are maximizers. You look at Wallace, you look at Battier, I think Kobe has probably maximized his talent, which is remarkable considering how much talent he has. LeBron and Dwight Howard are still works in progress, but I think they have the ability to do that. But that's what I respect about these guys. I respect their ability to say, okay, even though I'm famous and making money and doing all this, I'm really going to focus on the craft of this.
The final chapter of your book features LeBron James. No surprise there at all. He is widely regarded as the most dominant player in the game today. 70% of his colleagues in the NBA regard him that way. But in the epilogue, you tell the story of a middle-aged mutual fund manager who beat Michael Jordan one-on-one. Tell us of the triumph of John Rogers Jr. and how his victory constituted art rather than luck.
Yeah, I love that. And in a very small sense, it perhaps undercuts everything that comes before in the book. John Rogers Jr. Is the head of Ariel Mutual Funds, very successful man, based out of Chicago. And he played at Princeton in the early 80s. But he doesn't look like a basketball player. You know, he's about 6'2". He's got the rec specs. You know, he's at that point where there's a brace on every part of his body. And he went to this Jordan flight camp and this was a few years back here, and Jordan used to have this thing where he would play campers one-on-one, you know, to three baskets, and Jordan had apparently never lost. And Rogers, you know, doesn't look like much of a player. So as Jordan often does, he sort of let Rogers get a first shot off. And when Rogers hit a crazy shot, Jordan was like, yo, you know, good job, ha, ha, ha. And then Jordan was going to impose his will upon him with some jumpers. But then Jordan happened to miss a couple jumpers, and it comes down to the final point, and Rogers has the ball, and he drives left on Michael, and you can tell that Michael has now decided he's actually going to play defense. So when Rogers jumps up in the air, Michael jumps with him, and he's pretty much like an umbrella over him. He's got everything covered. There's no way Rogers is getting this shot off. And Rogers, you know, he tells me later, he's practiced this move his whole life. He does one of these, like, spinning lefty from the hip underneath scoop shots that hits almost like the top of the board and then spins in. And as he shoots it and hits it, you can hear Jordan screaming, oh, no! And that's it. That's the first time Jordan loses. And it was just this wonderful moment. Actually, it's captured on video. And Rogers, you know, he ended up having copies, DVDs made for everyone he works for. And, you know, who can blame him kind of thing.
Chris Ballard is the author of The Art of a Beautiful Game, The Thinking Fan's Tour of the NBA, a Sports Illustrated book published by Simon & Schuster. And he joined me from UC Berkeley. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much, Bill.
My conversation with Chris Ballard about his new book, The Art of a Beautiful Game, The Thinking Fan's Tour of the NBA, will be featured on this week's show. I'll also be talking with Tim Kirkjian about Major League Baseball's winter meetings and which teams have benefited most from the various trades that have already occurred. I wonder if he'll say the Yankees are still the Yankees, but now they've also got Curtis Granderson. We'll have a story about the football team at Northwest Missouri State, an aggregation that certainly knows their way to the Division II championship game, having been there five times in the last 5 years. Now if they could only win it. We'll also have a story about the swimming program at Kenyon College, where nobody knows how to do anything but win, and certainly most significantly we'll present our 17th annual Only a Game holiday gift guide, which will give you the excuse you've needed for putting off your holiday shopping until Saturday. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.